Welcome to season four of From the Heart with me, Dawn Lister. Today I'm joined by Ali Miller. Ali is author of The Last Days. I'm very excited to talk to Ali. She is, as well as being an author, she's a mother and a wife and a fully rounded out person. I'm really excited to have this conversation with Ali. We met via Instagram when I discovered Ali's book, which was a biography about her childhood growing up as a Jehovah's Witness. And as many of our regular listeners will know, as I speak quite often about my early days as a Jehovah's Witness also, and the impact that that had on me for the good and for the bad. I was very, very excited to read the book and took it away on holiday and cried about 3 days solidly at this really powerful personal narrative, which I really highly recommend if you enjoy reading or you have been involved in or are curious about cults and high control relationships or religions. This is one of the best books I have ever read. Very honest, very truthful. Thank you so much for writing it. Abby's book was listed in The Guardian as Book of the Year. She was also had a 6-page spread in the Sunday Times. She was highlighted in the Sunday Post. She was in the Scotsman's One to Watch book 2022. And she was Scottish Book Trust Book of the Month also. My goodness, you did really well. I knew when I read the book, Abby, that it was special. You have a gift as a writer and a storyteller. And I wasn't surprised by any of the accolades that you have received. So many, many congratulations. I know that the work that you have done and are continuing to do is going to be far reaching and going to be so, so helpful to people that are leaving the Jehovah's Witness cult and actually other cults also. So welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's always quite strange to hear as someone else talking about your work when I've known it sort of in every incarnation and early drafts, and when I was tearing my hair out about how bad it was and would it ever get published. And so it's kind of nice to hear it presented in that way and to think, oh yes, actually I did do that. It's a strange out-of-body experience, I think.
Yeah, I can imagine. It was as I read it, there were so many things that I resonated with. And interestingly, Ali and I grew up just a few miles from each other. So we were both from Edinburgh and we were in two congregations not that far from each other. We were in something that was called a circuit. So we were within the same circuit. So Abby was in Waverley congregation, I believe, and I was in Muirhouse congregation. And you're a few years younger than me, so we didn't meet. I would imagine that by the time I had left, you were just starting to become aware of what was going on around you. But it's kind of weird when I saw your book and I saw that, you know, we'd grown up in the same area and had lots of the same reference points. It resonated even more. Ali, I'm really grateful for lots of different things. One of the things, and maybe you can speak to this a little bit yourself, as a kicking off point, is that growing up in the Jehovah's Witness religion, women weren't allowed a voice. And we were not allowed to stand on what was called a platform, or you could say a pulpit, might be another way of explaining it, and give teachings. We had to be humble and quiet and in subservience to the male figures around us. So it's been a bit of a struggle for me throughout my life, learning to speak up, kind of on the one hand desperately wanting to speak up and probably speaking up in ways that weren't helpful, and to find, you know, my own voice has been a challenge. And it's got to the point where now at 52 I'm finally being comfortable enough to hold a podcast on my own, for instance, and do things without somebody necessarily supporting me, because that imposter syndrome was so strong. So when I read your book and really felt the strength of your female power, it was really empowering to hear and liberating. Could you speak a little bit about what that was like for you, if you had a similar experience?
I found the whole process of writing it very interesting, that process of learning how to draw something out of me learning how to draw the story out of me. So the first few drafts, I wrote it in second person. So I didn't use I, and part of the reason I didn't use I was because there wasn't an I until I left the religion. There was a you. I felt like I was watching myself all the time when I was growing up. And when you're part of a collective, there's a group think, there's a group mentality. I almost spoke in my internal voice in that way, and I wanted to bring that to the page, but a lot of publishers didn't like it because they felt that there was a barrier, and they were right. I was using that as a way of not actually fully inhabiting my voice as well. I think I was using that still as a way of hiding, even though I'd written the early manuscripts and early drafts. I was very terrified about the thought of it being published. I was really scared about the thought of actually telling this story, because as a witness, you're told that the one thing you can't do is make public what happens to you. So I was terrified of becoming what they call apostate. I didn't want to be in that position. So one of the things that my editor used to say to me very early on was, you know, what are you thinking here? What are you experiencing? You're still very distant. You're distancing the reader. And I realized that I was still trying to tell the story, but also trying to push the reader away at the same time. So I was trying to conceal a lot of the story and how I actually felt in relation to what was happening with the story. And that was one of the struggles editing the book, was overcoming that. And then after it got signed, and when people were talking about it, people were saying, oh, you've been very brave. And I didn't feel like I'd been brave at all, because I felt like I'd written it in a room on my own. And in a way, it didn't feel like using my voice. It just felt I wrote it down. And it was really hard to do. I was ill quite a lot of the time when I was writing it. I'd have panic attacks, I'd be sick, I'd needed to wash. Every time I finished writing, I had to just kind of scrub myself to feel clean. But I didn't feel like I'd really found a voice or used a voice, just because it was such a solitary thing. And then about 6 weeks before it was published, I recorded the audiobook. And I had to record that with a producer listening, so he listens on the headphone while I read the book. And as I did that, I felt this real power. It was the first time I'd felt like, wow, I've told this story. I've told my story. And at that stage, it still felt like it was my story I told. And then the piece in the Times came out about 3 weeks before publication. And that piece was about the elders coming up to the house and interrogating me about really private. And I got messages from people all over the world, from readers, mostly women, saying, wow, for the first time I've seen what happened to me. And I thought it had only happened to me. I wrote it thinking it had only happened to me. And at that point, it switched from being my story to me telling a bigger story and realizing that, yes, I had not just found my voice, but I'd begun to give voice to these other stories and children growing up in this way, and women trapped, and women in essentially a coercive relationship with a religion. And that felt vaguely terrifying as well, because you obviously want to be able to do a good job and not let people down, because, you know, you're suddenly in this position that you've told a story that people can relate to. So it's a really strange process to finding my voice. And I remember things like, sometimes at the meetings I would answer for too long and the elders would start coughing on the platform, or, you know, or they would cut in if you kept speaking for too long. And even in interviews, early interviews, I had to learn to actually like talking as well, and that it was okay to say things and take up space. And then I sort of thought it was done. I thought, well, I found my voice. I wrote a book, and then I discovered that actually this is like unpicking what happened to us is a life's work, and holding on to your voice and, you know, not being sick of it and still thinking you've got something worth saying is something that I have to work on recently. So I thought, well, I've said it, I've got nothing else worth saying. And then I have to keep thinking, no, you do, you know, and again, that's conditioning that goes way back to how we were raised, and the really abuse isn't too strong a word to say, to use for what happened to us.
Yeah. Thank you, Ellie. That was a really eloquent, honest answer. It's so interesting to hear you say at the beginning, I wrote it, I didn't write it in the first person, and you use that as a device to distance yourself. And that's, I can really relate to that, you know, throughout, as you were saying, I'm thinking, gosh, when I speak about my past, I often will say, oh, I don't feel like it happened to me. Because it feels mm-hmm. like that part of my life feels like it happened to somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
It evidently still has work to do.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's really funny because in a way it didn't happen to you. It didn't happen to who you are now. It happened to who you had to be then. And so there is a real, like almost like quite an uncomfortable segregation between those two times.
Mm-hmm.
And I've found recently trying to integrate who I was then with who I am now, instead of keeping it so separate, because I don't think that's healthy either. So it takes a long time. But I read a really brilliant book recently called Nina X by another Scottish writer called Ewan Morrison, and that's about a woman who grows up in a cult, essentially, and the whole way through she calls herself Nina. She doesn't use I, and she's not been allowed to use I, and anytime she writes I, she rubs it out, so on the page it's actually like in grayscale, so it looks like she's erased it. And I thought that was one of the best portrayals of how people are erased by group mentality, and how groups take away that I. And I think there's something really interesting with how we use language and how language can explore that too. So I think that's why writing has always really appealed to me, because I was very aware very early on that we were given literature as witnesses and made to read, and kind of the power of the written word becomes really embedded in you. And I think that was perhaps another way of taking back a voice was, well, I will write something because I've always been told that's what's written down matters and is true and must be listened to. Mm-hmm. So I think that's definitely why I chose a book over any other form of activism or any other form of expression too.
Mm. Thank you. Before we jump into some more conversation and questions, I would really love it if you would read the first section of your book, which kind of lays out kind of what it meant and means to be a Jehovah's Witness growing up, what our life was like, those first few pages, if you wouldn't mind.
Absolutely. Now, this, again, talking about language, is quite interesting because I wrote it as we, because I wanted to show how the group worked and how it is to be part of that collective. Shall I just read the whole piece?
Yes, please do. Thank you.
Perfect. So it's called The World Within the World. It is 1982, and in the Kingdom Hall, we are Jehovah's Witnesses. Outside the Kingdom Hall is the world. We know the whole world is lying in the power of the Wicked One, whose sole mission is to lead us away from Jehovah and his life-giving ways. The state of the world, where men become lovers of pleasure rather than of God, shows us the end is close, and Satan is like a roaring lion seeking to devour us. Our 5 things a week keep us safe, as does studying our Bible-based literature. Inside the Kingdom Hall, we are all brothers and sisters who speak the pure language. We are one happy family, part of the worldwide association of Christian brothers. We are here to receive Jehovah's instructions. We have a few simple beliefs, and these are not burdensome. We believe the Bible is the infallible word of God. We believe every word of it to be true. We do not believe in a heavenly hope. Instead, we believe Jehovah God has anointed 144,000 humans to serve at his side for eternity. Everyone who survives his coming judgment will live forever on earth. We do not believe in hellfire. Jehovah is a God of love. We do not believe in the Trinity because it is an impossibility. We believe Jesus is God's Son and was sent to earth to deliver us from sin. We believe Eve's sin brought pain, suffering, and death into the world. We believe the earth was created in 6 days, although we do not know exactly how long a biblical day is. We know birthdays, Christmas, and Easter are all of pagan origin. We shun false worship and do not celebrate any worldly holidays. Instead, we annually observe the death of Christ. This is a time to reflect on the value of the ransom sacrifice and what it means for us as Jehovah's people. We believe blood is sacred, and under no circumstances would we accept a blood transfusion. If we should die because of this, we know we have made Jehovah's heart glad, and he will reward us with everlasting life. We believe our bodies are holy. We do not pollute them with drugs, tobacco, or excessive alcohol. We do not engage in premarital sex. We believe homosexuality is a sin from which we flee. We believe we must live according to the gender assigned to us at birth. Husbands are the head of the family. Wives, children must be submissive. We believe worldly education is of little value and avoid further education. We know the love of money is a trap and take care not to be ambitious. Brothers often work for themselves. Sisters raise the family. To keep the congregation clean, we disfellowship unrepentant wrongdoers, taking care not to associate with them afterwards. This is an act of love. We know Jehovah is our best friend. This heavenly friendship is more important than all earthly ones. Jehovah has chosen to save us personally from the darkness of the world. We draw close to Jehovah by praying to him 3 times a day. We believe the dead will be resurrected. This gives us much hope and comfort. We see death as a temporary state, akin to sleeping. We have a direction and purpose that worldly people lack. Our purpose is to warn others the end is coming. The Battle of Armageddon will bring the end, and only baptized members of Jehovah's earthly organization will survive. After this, we will live forever in paradise. These are the beliefs that unite us in worship. These are the beliefs we teach each other in our Christian ministry. These are the beliefs you listen to and laughed at to begin with until you needed to believe them, until they were the comfort and salve they were intended to be. These are the beliefs that sound both facile and monstrous now from a distance. These are the beliefs that were mine too, so short a time ago. These are the beliefs you fed to me. These are the beliefs you said would save my life, and neither of us knew, not then, what they would do to us.
Wow. Hearing it read back has given me a cold chill. I'm not in a good way.
It was very chilling to write that bit and to think that I thought it was great to believe that. Yeah.
But then how else could we have thought, because we were children?
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, you trust your parents, you have to, for your survival. It's a biological need. That was hard to hear back. That was hard to hear back. And as I was listening to it, I was also thinking about why it was so important to me that as I launched season 4 of this podcast as a solo host, that it was about where I came from.
Mm-hmm.
And you did such a wonderful job of explaining where we came from, and out of where we came from, there's a lot of a huge amount of pain and loss and grief, there's also, it put me on a journey of growth, which, you know, we'll talk about that in a little while, you know, for you, what that was like for you, and it brought me to this point where I do the work that I do mm-hmm. now, looking after other people and working in a therapeutic way. When you think back now to, you know, your childhood growing up in such a controlling environment, surrounded by fear, feeling isolated from the world around with you, what do you think that did to you? Could you speak to that in some way?
I think it made me, whatever that means. And I wouldn't change it, really, weirdly. And I've thought about this over and over, because that was one of the questions I think that I got asked a lot last year, like would you change it? And apart from the fact that the book wouldn't exist, that's not why I wouldn't change it. I wouldn't change it because I don't know who I would be. And I don't like these sort of hypothetical, I could have been this and I could have been that, because I think it just breeds discontent. I don't think it is particularly useful. What it did was it gave me quite a unique way, I think, of seeing lots of things, because I was kept separate and I couldn't fully inhabit the world outside of the witnesses. But because my mom came into the witnesses and the rest of her family weren't witnesses, I knew about the world outside. I saw my grandparents functioning well. I saw these successful people. I saw my cousins who were happy and had a really rich upbringing. I saw that. And so I wasn't fully either. I feel that although I had a lot of witness belief put on me and I was very devout and I completely believed it, I didn't feel like I belonged. I never felt at home at the meetings or at home in the congregation. Other people would describe these feelings of safety and completeness, and I didn't get that. But likewise, I did get it when I was at my grandparents' house. I couldn't fully embrace it either. So I was sort of in this middle place where I watched both. And I think that's really useful for becoming a writer. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of writers have described similar things or have had similar, like, sort of fractured upbringings where they've had to kind of inhabit different realities. And so I think that it was really valuable, despite being really awful and being something that I would never want someone else to endure. I wouldn't want to put that ever on my children. That was part of the reason I left. But I think that that kind of ability to see different realities was really useful. And I also think leaving, when you go through the process of mentally leaving and mentally unpicking it, again, it gives you a really valuable perspective and really valuable lessons, because you've got to do so much inner work and you've got to, you know, build a person as well. You've got to figure out, like, who the hell you are, what you're for, who you want to be going forward. You know, there's so much that you have to do, and I think a lot of other people never have to do that. I think if I'd had a simpler life, I certainly wouldn't be, like you say, you're doing the work you do because of what happened to you. Mm-hmm. I'm doing what I do because of what happened to me. I wouldn't have this life. I wouldn't be your same person, and the thought of not having that is a really strange thought. I love what I have and I love what I do. It's funny to reconcile that kind of really difficult past still can bring you somewhere really good.
Yeah, that's so true. And it's funny, I've come to a similar point in my life in the past probably 10 years, maybe a little bit less, where I'm at peace with the past. It still hurts me. It still upsets me from time to time. But I've gone through that. And I don't know if maybe you can speak to this, if it happened to you also, where I went through a wild stage. It was like somebody let me out of a playpen. And also because when I left, maybe we could speak very briefly to framework. This Jehovah's Witnesses say that there will be a great tribulation and that millions, billions will die. If you're not a witness, you're going to die. And that's that. And so I genuinely believed growing up the people around me that I loved and cared for were going to die if they weren't Jehovah's Witnesses. And I felt it was my moral duty to tell everybody. In fact, growing up, I used to come home from school and get my little briefcase and go out preaching, you know, 13, 14 years old, because I was like, the sooner I save everybody, the sooner the new system can come, and then maybe that person won't die. And it felt like a moral responsibility. It was huge. And when I did leave, I still believed, but I just couldn't do it anymore. Mm-hmm. So I was like, I'm going to party, and I'm going to party hard. And I did. And it was chaos. You know, how I'm still alive is a miracle, frankly. And then I came out of that and went into a very much an angry place when I kind of woke up and went, what a load of bollocks. What have I been fed? Why did they feed me that? You know, and then blaming my parents. And it took me a long time to get past the blaming the parents and seeing that, well, they're in a cult and being brainwashed. And to get past that and forgive them. So I don't know what that was like for you. Did you have a similar curve or?
Absolutely, very similar trajectory. I left and I mean, I didn't have my daughter every second weekend. So those weekends were like, I just went out. I was out, I was with people. I also wanted to discover, because we'd obviously been told that worldly people were really bad, really sinful. So I sort of went looking for like to find out how sinful they were. And I was quite disappointed sometimes because I was like, oh, it's not as bad. I thought it was going to be like uber rock and roll. And it was just a little bit rock and roll. It wasn't like what I was expecting. But I did have that sort of like better make the most of it because it's not going to last for long stage as well. Because I was the same as you when I left, I still believed that the end was coming. I didn't believe they were God's chosen organization because I didn't think they were very nice and I'd been treated really badly. But other than that, I was like, maybe Armageddon's coming. I did believe that bit. And that took the longest to unpick. And then I went through the angry stage when I discovered that the organization is much more a business entity than a religion that's just manipulating people and using people and controlling people. When I discovered that bit, I was really cross. And when I started writing the book, I was quite cross as well. Anger was the prevailing emotion that I felt. And then I just got really sad. And I felt sad for a long time. But writing the book took away the anger. And I'm not angry about it now. And I'm not sad about it. I really miss my mom. That's the thing. That having that sort of living death and experiencing a living grief is an absolute horror that nobody should ever have to be subjected to. That's the worst part. But other than that, I'm at peace. Yeah, with the past, and can see how it's led me to here and how it's actually given me a rich and valuable perspective that I can continue to explore in my work. So yes, I find it valuable. It's not to say that there aren't moments where PTSD can be really hard to live with and really hard to experience. And sometimes I get awful flashbacks and I sometimes get very tired when I've been talking about it or when I've been talking to other people about it. But yeah, there is overwhelmingly a feeling of peace. But I think that what you were talking about when you had like your, what they would term as a rebellious stage when you were being mad, when I was partying a lot, when I was trying to work out things. I think what it is like, if you watch children, they're always establishing what their limits are. You know, you'll see them, like some children will be like, I'll climb this really high tree and I'm fine with it. Other children are on the low log kind of staggering along. And I think that was partly what I was trying to do. I was trying to find my limits, my moral limits, my what am I happy with and what am I unhappy with? Where do I feel safe? I had to make myself feel unsafe to learn where my safety was, all that way of learning that is forbidden to you as well when you grow up in that setting, because we weren't allowed to explore our sexuality or drugs or our relationship with alcohol, or all of that was forbidden. And because it was all forbidden, we couldn't find our own level either. So I had to go through quite an extended process of finding like what I was happy with and what I wasn't happy with, and what I could accept and what I couldn't accept, even in terms of like culture as well, books, film, everything, because that also was kind of off limits.
Thank you. That's a really vivid depiction of exactly, you know, what it's like to step out and kind of work out, as you say, work out who you are in a framework of a much wider world. You know, we grew up in such a tiny little bubble. And, you know, and this is very typical of a cult, and I would call Jehovah's Witnesses a cult. These fit into the cult definition, certainly, that you know, you don't read outside the context of what they offer you, and you don't question. And I remember very early on when we had to do our baptism questions, and they kept, I really had trouble with the idea of the sacrifice that Jesus was sent to earth by God and he had to die to forgive us for our sins. And I remember, you know, my baptism being delayed for quite a while because I kept saying, but if God's so powerful, why can't he just forgive us anyway? Like, it's not our fault we're born into sin, surely. And no, and in the end, I had to just pretend, because I so badly wanted to be baptized to be in the club, that I got it. And I never got it because it just didn't make any comment. It didn't make any sense to me. But we weren't allowed to question. And one of the things I was constantly pulled up on was, you're too questioning. You ask too many questions, you have no faith. And I used to say, but I can't have faith in something there's no evidence for. And then I was, literally told, don't use big words. You know, don't use big words. You don't even know what that means. And so when I left, and I was very lucky, I had two things that happened. One of the first things, I had a job just as a waitress in this little coffee shop. And I remember passing this on the stairs, it was a pivotal moment. I'm passing the stairs, my manager, and he stopped me and he just put his hand on my shoulder and he said, you're doing so well. Everybody really loves you. And I just burst into tears. He's, oh my God, I didn't mean to touch you. And I was like, no, it's fine. I said, you're just so nice. And I didn't tell him why I was upset, but I was upset because for the first time in my life, I'd been in contact with worldly people, in inverted commas, who weren't around me because my parents were there and we happened to be on holiday or something. I was on my own as a human being. And they were lovely. And they were much nicer than the witnesses I'd ever encountered. And it was it really threw my head into a spin because I didn't know what to do with that. And that was the beginning of my unraveling. You know, I should go back and thank him if he's still alive. And then later on, when my 19, I moved to London and I became a nanny to a wonderful family. And actually, they're in publishing. They're both in publishing. One's a publisher for Random House and the other one was a literary agent. And they questioned everything. And the conversations I had with them when we spoke about anything, they'd say, yeah, but why? And where's your evidence? And have you read this? And they put books in front of me. Mm. And I literally inhaled for 3 or 4 years everything I could read. I read novels and I read philosophy and I read Plato and I read, you name it, I read it. I read everything and I wanted to, and I had the opportunity to talk to people that made it okay to question. And throughout life, that's been a theme for me. I question everything, but I still have had, until recent years, a fear around pushing back. I don't know if that was something that was similar for you. You know, did you find it hard to sort of stand your ground and say, well, I have a different opinion and, you know, and these are the reasons why? Or was that something, did you hold on to that black and white thinking, I guess I'm asking?
So in terms of black and white thinking, definitely not. I struggled as a child as well to see everything black and white. It didn't come naturally to me. And then as a teenager, I was very anorexic and was for quite a long time. And I think that was my way of not having to question. It was my way of like stopping my thoughts, because I didn't think about God. I literally thought about food and exercise and thinness. And that was all that just occupied me for the best part of a decade. And I think weirdly, that was sort of my way of staying safe. It was definitely my way of staying a witness. Otherwise, I would have started to ask the questions. Then when I left, I did very similar. So I left and enrolled quite early on in an MA in creative writing. So I arrived at the university, and I still remember, like, students were talking about arcs, and I literally thought that was like what no one went in. I didn't realize they were talking about character arcs, and I'd been really good. I'd been a really devout witness. I hadn't like read any philosophy. I hadn't read anything like that. I'd read bits of like Camus and I'd read novels that I shouldn't read, but I hadn't read like any theory or like anything like that. And encountering that for the first time was incredible. I just had like just filled myself up, just read everything, learned to question everything, like you say, where's the evidence for that? How do we back this up? And not just blindly believing and not just making blind statements either. But it took me a long time to be able to say, no, I don't believe that, or I think. And I think part of that was that when I left, I saw everyone else, because I was nearly 30 when I left. So it had been a long time. And I saw everyone else on the outside as having much more, as knowing much more than me. And they did. They had had much more experience of culture. They'd had much more exposure. They'd seen a lot more. And I weirdly still struggle with what I'm working on just now. I've struggled with kind of like saying, I think this, and actually like putting down opinions, saying, I think this based on X, Y, or this is an observation I've made about this piece of art or this film. And I find that's quite funny that I'm not only now at the stage of going, oh, I think I know enough to be able to state an opinion, or to like not think I'm going to get in trouble if I state my own mind. I always, for quite a long time, I still hold on to that I'm going to get in trouble if feeling as well. But I'm definitely, it was funny recently, someone professionally called me uncompromising, and I was like, no, I'm not. I compromise at everything. And then I thought about myself over the last couple of years, and I thought, oh, actually, they have a point. Suddenly, I think you just suddenly reach a different stage in your life, and you don't realize you've got there, and you don't quite know how you got there either. A lot of it's connected, I think, to the book and getting a lot more confident at stating things and confident in myself. But yeah, it's funny when you suddenly go, oh, actually, maybe I am shaking the final vestiges of this, because I'm actually now able to have an opinion and not feel bad about that too.
Yeah, and it's interesting, and I've three daughters, and as I've brought them up, massively to have a voice, to say what they think and to disagree and to push back. And I remember growing up, I still had contact with my mother for up until about 8 years ago. We were 9 years now. We were still in contact, and she would see the children and she'd say, oh, you're making a rod for your own back. They've got far too much of a voice. And, you know, I mean, I think part of that's to do with her age, but a huge part of that certainly is to do with being brought up as bringing us up as Jehovah's Witnesses. And, you know, for them, I mean, I remember explaining to people, my parents, they genuinely think I'm going to die because I've left. Like, they 100% think I'm going to die, and they think I'm going to have a horrible death because I know why I'm where I should be. So therefore, when I do die at the Great Tribulation, it's going to be far more painful than everybody else, and that'll be my fault. And so they're my parents, and we speak about the grief that we have because we have no contact with our parents, but there's also the grief that they have because in their mind, they've lost their children. However, I also feel like because of what happens to someone in a cult, there's a part of the brain that gets shut down where they feel like, I couldn't begin to imagine cutting one of my children off for anything they did. You know, they're your children. I mean, we all have moments where we fall out a bit, or we disagree, or we retreat to their corner for 5 minutes, you know, to, you know, gather themselves and come back, especially as you get older. But, you know, they're your children. I can't imagine anything that would stop us wanting to be, you know, have them in our lives. But that's certainly true for our parents. You know, they've let us go, and they've walked away from us. And so I've completely lost the point of what I was saying, but you know, that is a fact. We don't have our parents in our life. And, you know, we've brought our children up. I imagine you've the same, to have that voice and to speak up and to really, you know, stand up in the world as independent women and say, I'm an equal to you. And that gives me great pleasure every day to watch them say, well, it's just a bloke, you know, I don't have to bow and scrape to anybody, mum, it's fine. Because on the one hand, I know that, but maybe somewhere unconsciously, I still maybe don't fully embody that. I don't know. I would like to think I did. What about you? Do you see that something you've tried to embody in your children?
Definitely. And yeah, my children are very vocal. They're very opinionated. They're always talking about evidence as well. They're always asking, like, how do I prove this? And they're very skeptical. I think they're sort of little born skeptics, but I don't know if I've influenced that too. But they're very forthright, and that's always been encouraged. That's completely encouraged at home, as you know. And I would never say you do this because I'm the adult or I'm your parent and I expect you to do this. And again, that's so much of my childhood influencing as a kickback to how I parent. And I think most of how people parent is based on how they were parented, for better or worse. But definitely encourage children to question, encourage them to question their teachers, question everything, question everybody. And yes, it is harder, like your mom said, it is harder, but I believe it's the right way to parent. So it's what I'm going to do, because I love the idea of having strong, opinionated adults around me who I've helped raise. My eldest was 18 yesterday, and she certainly got her own opinions and her own ways of doing it. And it's really satisfying to see, actually, when it's difficult. I was explaining that to her yesterday, that obviously it's not always easy, and mother-daughter relationships certainly aren't always easy, but I love that the parts of her that sometimes are the bits that I find the most difficult are also the bits that I'm the most proud of too, in that kind of, yeah, you will answer back, and yes, you will question. And I just think it's lovely to see. And you can also see these sort of intergenerational things that you manage to break is a big thing too.
I, as you were just saying that, that was my next question. There's a big part of what we talk about throughout all the seasons of the podcast has been intergenerational trauma, and how, you know, we all carry the echo in our tissues and our genes, but also in our minds and in our behavior patterns from previous generations. But I do feel that, you know, this generation is the generation where I say I'm breaking the pattern. So whilst I may still be holding some of the suffering, working daily to release it, I feel like I haven't passed that to my children. I don't feel like they stand in the shadow that I stood in growing up. And it's wonderful to see that that's possible. And I think that these things become possible through the way we are in the world. You know, there's a healing that takes place when you become consciously aware that the way you've been brought up or certain habits that you may have developed are unhealthy. And once you're aware of them, then you can do something about them. Until there's an awareness, there's nothing that can happen. And then once the awareness is there, we can start to look at different ways that we can begin to heal and rebuild ourselves. Would you say you had other practices, which we could label, if you like, spirituality, other than writing, that you have done to sort of begin to heal yourself from what happened to you when you were a child?
I would say that I don't have a lot that I would label spirituality. I really struggle with anything that feels organized. I think just because of coming from something that literally called itself organization, I struggle with that. And I struggle with a lot of some of the more popular spirituality techniques that maybe have a kind of cultiness associated with them. And I struggle a little bit with that. But things that I do love that have definitely impacted, like how I feel and how I behave, are all very rooted in storytelling and myth. I love myth. I love storytelling. I love sitting with the kids and reading to them, just that those moments of closeness. And that was when I felt the closest to my mother, even if we were reading the Bible together, to actually sit and just be together. And I think there's a lot to be said for feeling relaxed with your caregiver, because that's when you can start talking to them and that's when you can open up. So I really love those moments. But also, like, I love cooking, so I cook a lot. I love walking. I'm outside a lot. I try and be outside. Like, I live in the city, but I'm really fortunate that I live close to a lot of parks and commons, so I try and make sure that every day I'm out walking and I'm in nature and I'm thinking, and all those things I think really help. I'm actually writing at the moment at the very beginnings of what might go on to be a book, but I'm writing about art and how viewing art and visual art and culture has in many ways become my new god and has replaced things. And really, I get a lot from shared culture. And I think that what that offers and what spirituality offers, or what any kind of belief system offers, is that feeling of belonging to something, and the feeling of something that's bigger than you, that will outlive you and outlast you as well, that you can find some kind of meaning in. And I feel in an art gallery, I feel like I always wanted to feel when I was at the Kingdom Hall, and I never got that feeling of transcendence or escape or anything. And the times I feel that now are when I'm in an art gallery, or when I'm at a packed gig, or when I'm on the dance floor, you know, when you're with people and you're having this shared powerful experience. Not the same experience, because everyone is experiencing it differently, but just something that's moving you and takes you outside your body. And those are things that I do with the kids as well. They're always taken to art galleries, and they're always taken to films, and I take them to all these things. We watch films at home. I've been going through a big Bergman phase, and the 10-year-old has been watching them with me, and we talk about it, and yeah, all of that I think is definitely where I get my meaning. And I think that that's the most important thing, that we learn how to make meaning to life, essentially.
Yeah. Thank you. I was really moving to hear. I am interestingly, as a teenager, we have some similarities here. I also was anorexic. I think it's not uncommon amongst young women in the Jehovah's Witness faith, and carried on with an eating disorder until I was in my early 30s. I'm cured now. I love myself more than the need to control. But also as a teenager, I was very solitary. I didn't really fit in with any of the other witness kids. So I think we were quite poor, and I mean more poor than the average poor person, and I just didn't really have any conversation outside of church. And a lot of the so-called friends in the church, they were a bit more rebellious. I was too scared to be. So I took myself to art galleries all the time. I used to get on the bus and I'd go to the National Gallery at the bottom of the I think it's called the Mound, can't remember, it's been a while, in Edinburgh on Prince's Street. And I would be there for hours. And I'd just sit in front of various paintings. And that's that thing. It's almost like you disappear and you become the viewer within that painting. And whenever I go back to Edinburgh now, which sadly isn't very often, but I make a point of going back to the National Gallery. And where's your favorite gallery now? Where do you like to visit?
I spent a lot of time in the last 2 years at the Tate Modern. It's really easy for me to get to, and I love it there. I love IKB 79, which is the Yves Klein blue painting. I got quite obsessed with that when I was working on The Last Days, and when I needed to feel better after intense periods of being in the past, I would just go and look, like you say, I would just go and look at that painting. I would just stand in front of it, and just every time I went, it looked a different shade of blue as well, which I found amazing. Some days it felt really powerful, and I could almost like feel it from the next room pulling me there. And then I would just look at it, and I loved that. And then at the Hayward last year, there was a Louise Bourgeois exhibition, and you've probably seen me going on Instagram about her work, and I have become completely obsessed with her work. And I feel that it's sort of, in a very odd way that I'm trying to explore, has kind of guided me the last year or so. Her work's very bodily, and I think, you know, you'll know what it's like with anorexia. You become very interested in bodies and protest and what your body can do. And I feel her bodily work, her textile work, really has become to mean a lot to me. And I've got really fascinated in it. So I was at the Hayward a lot last year as well. But I feel so lucky in London, because we've got all these great galleries, and in the main, they're free and they're very accessible. And that's amazing to have as well. And it's the same with, you can get quite cheap cinema tickets and everything for kids. So that's lovely. But yeah, I would say that's probably become my new religion, as well as books. Writing is a massive part of staying well, not just of recovering, but of having a sense of community as well.
Yeah, thank you. I think it's important for our listeners. I'd love to share, you know, if you are somebody that's, you know, experienced being in a cult, and there's many cults, you know, within, it doesn't have to just be a religion, it could be within the yoga tradition, within the Buddhist tradition. There are many, many high control religions or so-called, you know, well-being places, where actually they're run by people who want to control you and get you to behave in a certain way. And when I left the faith, I spent many, many years looking for a new one. Mm-hmm. And I just felt like I was floating. I didn't know where to put myself. I never felt safe. So I kind of got heavily involved in Buddhism, and then I became part of the Anglican Church for a while. And then I kind of moved into another Buddhist tradition. And in the end, it took a long time. I let it all go and kind of looked for the practices that sustained me without having the need to be part of something that had rules and structure, that I learned to trust myself, that I could create those rules and structure for myself, and that I had a moral compass that didn't need, you know, somebody else to tell me where I began and end.
Yeah.
But that took work. And, you know, I think if you're listening in and you're thinking, you know, I relate to some of that, or maybe you're not in a cult or anything, but you do have an issue around, you know, working out who you are and where you begin and end and what you think and feel, you know, finding something that really speaks to you, you know, that speaks to you personally, helps you to work out who you are. And as you say, it could be cooking, it could be walking in the woods, it could be going to an art gallery, listening to a piece of music, getting lost in a book, it could be, you know, taking up a yoga practice that's about you, that's not about how you're being told to put your body in a position, certain position. Mm-hmm. You know, the minute somebody starts telling you that's not okay, you're doing it the wrong way, you have to question, well, where's that coming from and what's that really about? And feeling safe enough to ask those questions is really important. And I think for us, that certainly was taken from us, and it's something we've had to reclaim. And it's a bit of the warrior's journey to have to take that to begin that reclamation.
I think that's really fascinating and completely true. And what you say about trusting yourself really rings true. I was really separate from my intuition. I always had a really strong bodily sense of when I feel okay around people and when I don't. And so for a long time, I had sore tummies as a child, and I had headaches, and I had, my body was screaming at me, essentially. It was saying, you're not safe. And it was also saying, trust me, trust yourself. And I didn't trust myself for a very, very long time. It's only in the last couple of years that I've begun to really go, no, I can keep myself safe, thank you very much. And I can regulate myself, and I can do this. And all those practices have been really important in kind of in grounding that sense, and in grounding myself that I don't need someone to tell me what to do. I can tell myself what to do, like you say, developing that moral compass and thinking, no, I'm fine as I am, I'm not flawed. And also, I don't need saved, I don't need redemption, I don't, you know, you talking earlier about the idea of the savior and Jesus, and why did God not step in? Well, actually, fundamentally, we can save ourselves. So there's nothing that we need saved from. We can look after ourselves. And I think maybe art gives me that sense of creating something that will outlive me, and something bigger. I think I've always wanted something bigger than me to kind of slot myself into, to say, well, I belong in this tradition or in this bit. Mm-hmm. And that's what's useful. But yeah, as soon as someone comes in and starts, even if it's someone saying, you must read this, these are the books you have to read to belong, or these are the films you have to watch to belong to this cool bit, or, you know, I'm not into any of that. It's like, you know, you can trust yourself to choose what you like and where you fit.
Mm-hmm. And I think a big part of the work I do with people in therapy is to develop that trust, is like, let's explore it. What's happening? Like, listen to your body. One of the things I regularly say is trust what your body's telling you. If your nervous system's becoming activated in this situation, something is not okay. And that's okay. Absolutely. Like, trust it, believe it, listen to it. And you know, and okay, now let's find a way to regulate ourselves, and then we can ask the questions. And I think as witnesses, we were certainly, A, we were never taught how to regulate. We were in a perpetual state of fear. And secondly, the people around us weren't regulated, so we could never co-regulate anyway. The work of a cult is to keep people in a place of isolation and fear. Otherwise, you're going to stop being there. You're not going to show up for five meetings. You're not going to preach. You're not going to hand over a bit of money. You're going to start speaking to people outside, and you're going to open your eyes. And that's the last thing they want you to do. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it feels wonderful finally to feel, you know, completely free from that. Although obviously there is still some grief around not having family in my life, not to have parents. Can you maybe speak a little bit about your relationship with your mother and where that is now?
Yeah, I don't see my mum. I don't have contact with her. And that's the residual, the hardest part. And I thought it was very fair and very true what you said, that we experience the grief, but they also experience the grief, you know. And I think that was where initially quite a lot of my anger came from, not anger towards my mother, but anger towards the organization, that they had stolen me from her and stolen her years of being a grandmother and knowing her grandchildren. And, you know, my mother's mother, my granny, was a brilliant grandmother and such an important relationship for me, and thinking my children don't have that with her has been a really difficult thing to come to terms with. So I find that very hard. Mm-hmm. And it is hard to know that, you know, it must be very hard for her to see that I've written a book about it and I've done the unforgivable thing, I've spoken out. And that was really hard while I was writing the book as well. That was a hard thing to balance, knowing that it would be difficult for her, but I had to balance that with thinking the people that I could benefit and who it would help as well. So yeah, I don't see her, and it's very difficult. It's really hard. We were close when I was growing up. You know, she was a single mom, and after my sister left home, it was just me and her at home as well. And although there were difficult things, there was obviously really great things too. And there's a lot that I miss, and it's taken until recently for me to be able to talk about the good bits to the kids, because I didn't know like what to pass on and what not to pass on. I was almost afraid to do the good things that she did as well. So like she cooked with me and baked with me and those kind of things. And I was always quite afraid to cook with the kids or to bake with them. And I realized that that was connected with the loss of her. I haven't sewn for years. She taught me to sew and I love sewing. And very recently I got thread and fabric out again and started to sew, because I thought there's bits of her that I don't want to lose as well. But it becomes really complicated, I think. I don't even think it is complicated, isn't it?
It's so complicated. It's such a, it's in the world of mindfulness, which is a big part of my personal practice. We speak about, you know, everything's in a big circle or globe, and within the globe, there's dark bits and there's light bits, and we can choose where the two things can exist at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I think part of being brought up in a cult situation is that it's hard to see that it's either one or the other, it's good or bad. Mm-hmm. And it took me a long time to get to the place where to say, there was good there. Mm-hmm. And I was on a road trip with two of my girls and my granddaughter this weekend, and on the way back they were talking about, did you have nice holidays, mom? And I said, well, we didn't really have many because we didn't have much money, people didn't often back then, and we were skin. I said, but I do remember going to a caravan, and I remember it always being raining but it being fun, and that we ate lots of cake, and we used to climb this hill every year, this Blair Athol is a lovely, your listeners, if you're ever there, go to Blair Athol to do the walk up. The waterfall is beautiful. And then I said, but on the other hand, we still had to go to church. We had to go to Pitlochry Church because my dad wanted to make a good impression. So he wanted to be asked to come and speak there. And it wanted to be something, in inverted commas, in the church. So there was always an offset. But yeah, there were happy times. And then for a long time, I felt like I didn't want to acknowledge that there were, because it was like, you were just awful. You were horrible to me. You did X, Y, and Z. But actually, I don't feel like that now. I feel like they did what they felt was right based on their experiences and their childhoods, both of my parents, very traumatic, extremely traumatic childhoods. And of course, they were ripe for picking in a cult, and they just thought they were giving us something better. And they still do. And I'm sure there's, you know, they have four children, none of who they speak to. It's, you know, just tragic. So, you know, my practice is to remember every day that whilst there is darkness, there's also lightness, and I can hold both at the same time. There's enough of me. It's okay.
Exactly. And that comes back to learning to trust yourself and realizing that you're complete as a person as well. You don't need to see the world anymore in these binary terms either. We can handle the complexity.
Listen, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge, your wisdom, the raw truth of your narrative. It was, every time I think of it, I get the tingles. It was amazing. I know you have another book coming out. Would you like to tell us about what that is and when it's coming out?
Yes, so this is my first novel. My debut novel is called Ava Anna Ada, and it is out in January 24th, so actually not that long. With White Rabbit, who are a publisher at Orion, and they are publishing some really interesting, innovative, risky work. It's very different. It's a book about, I say it's very different, and then I'm about to say it's a book about the end of the world. So maybe it's not that different. It's I realize I've got this recurring preoccupation with endings, but it's been described as a fable, and I think it probably is a fable. I got very concerned looking at the really increasingly turbulent weather patterns and predictions for the future. Got concerned about those and our inability to sort of understand reality anymore based on how we consume reality through our phones and how we mediate everything through the phone screen. And if things look good, then they must be good, and how hell-bent we've become on constructing images that actually don't match our everyday existence as well. So I got very preoccupied with that. So I wrote this very quickly in a sort of state of fury, demented fury and rawness. And obviously then there's been a lot of editing and a lot of work on it, but I love it. It's very different. It's completely different to the last days, actually, and it feels like the last days was necessary to get out of me and out the way, and is a way of explaining like where a lot of my preoccupations come from, because obviously you grow up thinking that the end's coming, that's going to have a lasting effect, that becomes something that you think about a lot. We grew up thinking about images and all these things, so I wanted to get the last days out the way, and then I always wanted to write a novel afterwards. So that's been great. It's been really satisfying to work on. I signed off on it last week, so it's now out the way and over to other people to do publicity and cover and everything else. But I'm really looking forward to it.
Congratulations. It sounds thrilling. I mean, it sounds like the kind of conversation I have all the time, you know, with so many friends and clients around, you know, the world is blowing up, and there's a very small proportion of the world that is in great affluence who doesn't really care. And
no, yeah, exactly.
People are dying and losing their homes and losing their livelihoods just so we can continue to feed the capitalists' agenda that a tiny little proportion of the world is going to benefit from. And somehow we carry on being participant in it. And that's, you know, that's me being honest. I'm participant in it in some ways. I try not to be, but I fail regularly, as many of us do. And it's really hard not to.
Yeah, that was completely that sort of knowledge that our lives are predicated on other people's suffering. And I wanted to find a way of talking about how complicit we are and how horrific we've become in the Western world as well. There was a lot of those kind of thoughts that informed it, and I wanted to write something that was always serious and was looking at that seriously. So hopefully it works, hopefully I've succeeded, but we'll wait and see.
Remind us the name of the book is
Ava Anna Ada,
people, with White, what was the publisher called?
White Rabbit, White, like from Alice in Wonderland.
Let's go. Let's buy it. Let's buy it. Let's read it. It'll be a great holiday read over the January. It'll be great in January. And then come back and talk to us about it. It'll be a really interesting conversation.
I'd love to. Yeah, definitely.
Listen, it's been so wonderful to meet you finally after many Instagram conversations and to have this really rich conversation. It's nice to be able to talk to someone who's been there, who's had that lived experience and who's come at the other end sane, happy, and has made, you know, a real life for yourself and shining a light for others. Maybe, you know, just people listening and people reading your book will know that actually I can do it. I can break free and I can be okay. You know, I see an ending as a doorway also. You know, when something ends, there's such vast opportunity for something else to happen.
Absolutely. I think an ending is really only a beginning, so long as you can embrace that.
Okay. Thank you, everyone. Thank you to our listeners. Please do take a moment to leave a review. I hate it when people say that, but we have to say it. We have to say it because when you leave a review, we get pushed up the ranking and then more people get to hear these wonderful, rich conversations. Leave a review, leave a comment. Maybe tell us about your experiences of cults, maybe or high control relationships that you've witnessed or been in or escaped from. I'd love to hear your thoughts, and buy Ali's book. Buy it for yourself, buy it for your friends, share it around, read it in your book club. I highly recommend it. Thank you for today. Have a wonderful rest of your day, and thank you for listening.